This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up in September and into the rest of the months following, Purdue University Northwest is going to be offering through its faculty members an interesting series of lecture discussions, which are entitled Race, Racism, Anti-Racism. And in general, because of our issues here, not only in Northwest Indiana, but around the nation and the world, this is a very appropriate topic. Faculty members from the school, from the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences are going to be involved in this. It's a way to learn more about activists who are basically risking their lives for the sake of social justice. The series of discussions will begin on September 3rd. And you'll be able to see it. It'll be available by Zoom or Facebook Live as you choose to be able to join in. It's a free series of events. It's virtual, open to the public. And the first one, as we mentioned, is going to begin on Thursday, September 3rd. And it'll be the Return of Black-Led Grassroots Politics. And Glenn Ford, the executive director of Black Agenda Report, is going to be doing that. And our guest today is going to be doing the one following that. It's called Race and Wrongful Convictions. And Professor Nikki Jackson, who is a professor of criminal justice, is going to be joining Roosevelt Glenn, who is an exoneree, on this topic. And by the way, the conversation is going to be in the Zoom on Tuesday, October 6th, as part of the series. And Dr. Jackson, thank you for joining us here today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your interest, which is very deep, in the subject of wrongful conviction.
About 4.5 years ago, I read an article in the newspaper about a gentleman who had been wrongfully convicted for 24 years for crimes that he had not been committed. And I had to meet this gentleman, so I reached out to the reporter, and who then connected me to his attorney, and I met with Mr. Donald and sat down with him, I think a day or two after, and heard of what his journey has been like and how he lost 24 years of his life for crimes that he never committed. The guy had never even had a speeding ticket, to the best of my knowledge. So I had made some promises to Mr. Donald that I was going to be his voice and help make some change. And it was at that point that I started doing some research and recognizing that so many African-American males have been wrongfully convicted. And I also learned that most of our wrongful convictions in the state of Indiana had come from Lake County. And that was really bothersome as a professor at Purdue Northwest, which is housed in Lake County, and wanted to better understand what was taking place. So I started this journey, and it's a very long journey, but made some changes, and one of the changes that I wanted to see was a compensation bill for folks who had been wrongfully convicted in the state of Indiana. And thankfully, got some senators to listen and state reps, and we now have a bill in the state of Indiana which will offer compensation to exonerees. The bill is not perfect, and we're still in works with some modification requests, but we'll see how that goes. So that's really how I started this journey, and I've learned a great deal about wrongful convictions. I have spent the past 2 to 3 months now interviewing exonerees throughout the country. I've interviewed about 40 or 50 exonerees, male, female, Hispanic, African-American, white, and just learning more about their ordeals.
Have you found that being an advisory board member at both the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City and also at the Westville Correctional Center has not only helped keep you up to date with what is happening, but has helped offer the help that you may need in talking with people to get them to talk about what their issues are?
Well, it's interesting. As an advisory board member through the Indiana State Prison and Westville Correctional Center, I have other advisory board members that I have reached out to for guidance and assistance. And I've been very grateful that these folks have been able to answer my questions. In fact, I remember asking the former superintendent of Westville Correctional Center if he knew one of the exonerees, and he said he did not. And I said, well, he was, you know, under your charge. And he said, that's a good thing that I didn't know who he was. That means he was never in trouble. So that was an interesting, comment. But I have, I have definitely taken my experience as an advisory board and really restructured my thoughts and my approach as an advisory board member at the prison than when I had started many years ago.
When you and Mr. Glenn come on mm-hmm. for the conversation on October 6th, is there anything in particular, besides what you've kind of mentioned with us here as we talk, but that you'd like to bring forth to the people that are participants as well as those who are watching and listening at the time?
Mr. Glenn's ordeal is very important for folks to understand how race has played a major factor in those who've been wrongfully convicted. We know that minorities, particularly African Americans, are much more likely to be wrongfully convicted. I think about this. The National Registry of Exoneration shows that we have about 1,900 exonerees in this country. 47% are African American. And think about that, 47%, and 13% of our U.S. population are African American. So you can see how disproportionate these numbers are, right? These percentages are. We have way too many minorities sitting in prison, particularly African Americans, and we're finding that many of those who are incarcerated are there really unlawfully. They didn't commit crimes. I am on the board at the Caring Place, which is a domestic violence shelter located in Valparaiso. And my background really has been domestic violence. And what I've found is that there is a very strong connection between domestic violence and wrongful convictions. So it's very interesting that my research has brought me to a different area of research, but they are both connected. I found that many of these folks who've been wrongfully convicted have been products of homes where domestic violence occurred. And for females who've been wrongfully convicted, the majority of them, actually everyone that I've interviewed thus far, have been they have been wrongfully convicted based on some type of an intimate crime, and later learned that no crime even existed. No crime even existed. And so these women have spent many, many years in prison for crimes that weren't even crimes. One of the things that Mr. Glenn and I are hoping, to convey to those who are attending is how being black had impacted Mr. Glenn and his experience with the criminal justice system. I want people to understand that African Americans are much more likely to be wrongfully convicted for crimes, particularly murder, sexual assault, and drug crimes. In fact, innocent black people are 7 times more likely to be convicted of murder than white people. So those are innocent black people. And there's a host of reasons for that, but one of the factors that plays a role in why innocent black people are convicted of murder more so than white people is due to unconscious bias and due to explicit racism. Another crime that we see high rates of folks who are wrongfully convicted, particularly African Americans, is sexual assault. Blacks are 3.5 times more likely to be exonerated for sexual assault. And what leads to these African Americans who are innocent being wrongfully convicted in sexual assault cases is mistaken identification. Unfortunately, victims wrongly identify the perpetrator. And then the third type of crime where we see high rates of wrongful conviction by race is we see blacks are much more likely to be convicted. In fact, they're 12 times more likely to be wrongfully convicted for drug crimes. Yet blacks and whites, studies have shown that blacks and whites can use drugs at similar rates, but blacks are 5 times more likely to go to prison. And the reason we see more blacks going to prison for drug crimes than whites, even though they're committing them at the same rate, is that police are more likely to arrest African Americans than whites. Moreover, they're more likely to patrol areas where African Americans reside compared to whites. So we have to make some changes. There has to be some reform. And one of the things that Mr. Glenn and I will be talking about are some of the concerns that we have about the criminal justice system and its biases. We know that in Chicago, there was a commander, Detective Burge, John Burge, who in the early 90s, late 80s, I believe it was late 80s, mm-hmm. was torturing young African-American males into false confessions. He was forcing them to confess to crimes that they did not commit. And this was, you know, this was happening, and people were not speaking up. And I think it's time for change. It's time for change, and we need some reform. And we want to make sure that the right people are in prison for who've committed these crimes and not the wrong people. And these African-American males and females who have been wrongfully convicted have spent many, many decades in prison while the real perpetrator has been out on the street. Mistaken identification is the leading factor in sexual assault cases among African-American males. So we have victims who mistakenly identify the perpetrator based on dark skin, whatever type of hair, but they typically mistakenly identify African-American males. And we found that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem among sexual assault victims. They are wrongly identifying their perpetrators, particularly in cases where the perpetrator has been African-American.
Well, Dr. Jackson, thank you for what you tell us now. And we're looking forward to your presentation working alongside Roosevelt Glenn, the exoneree, on the topic that you're going to bring up with the conversation series October 6th. And it's entitled Race and Wrongful Convictions. And I'm sure that it will fit in nicely with the rest of the series that begins on September 3rd that you and your colleagues with Purdue University Northwest will be able to offer to anybody that views it on Zoom. And thank you for speaking with us today about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Nikki Jackson is a professor of criminal justice at Purdue University Northwest. She's been involved in the issues of wrongful convictions, and that is why she is going to be one of the participants in the series that begins on September 3rd that you can see on Zoom as well as join on Facebook Live as well. The other people that are going to be participating from Purdue University Northwest include Professor Lee Arts. He's a professor of communication. He'll be on November 3rd talking about media framing and the politics of racism. And then the series will wrap up on November 30th with Professor Kim Skypes, who's a professor of sociology, on how to talk about race in the 21st century. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I am a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing with the Northwest Indiana Special Education Cooperative. I started out teaching in Gary. Had the thought that I would move to somewhere else after my dad passed away. So I went to Georgia for a year. Hated that because I am strictly a Midwest girl. I cannot do anything south of Nashville. I know that now. And so I came back, went back to Gary for another couple of years. And then as the numbers decreased of the number of kids that they had who were deaf and hard of hearing in the Gary schools, I went to the Northwest Indiana Special Ed Cooperative because they service, at the time, they had 10 different school districts. So there was a lot more job security there. We would always have a number of deaf and hard of hearing kids. And so I've been doing this. This is my 21st year. My work day is, it's kind of varied because I'm an itinerant teacher. So what that means is because we, at this time, we have 8 member school districts in our cooperative. So I go to the students. The trend now is to mainstream a lot of students. So I may have just one student in the entire district that's deaf and hard of hearing. So I may have some students who I may be at a preschool with a 3-year-old In the morning, and then in the afternoon, I have to go work on some transition planning for a student that's about to graduate from high school. I could be in 5 different school buildings in the course of a day. The biggest challenge for me in teaching deaf and hard of hearing students is keeping up with the technology. I have a student that's learning American Sign Language, but that's not his primary mode of communication. So of the students that I have on my caseload, they're all spoken language. So they all have some type of technology, some type of hearing aids. They have cochlear implants now. And so it's just figuring out what's the best type of technology to help them in the classroom, because a lot of the classrooms now have laptops, Chromebooks. They use a lot of smart boards. And so just making sure that the students have access to that. Some of the joys of my work is when you see students make connections of things that you think is just so normal and everyday, but it's like something new to them. Something as simple as, if I take this blue crayon and color, and then I color a yellow crayon on it, look, it's magic. It turns to green. I had a student, and that just like blew his mind, just stuff like that. So for a whole week, that's all we did was just color and just mix colors. Seeing them making those discoveries and those connections, because they don't have access to the language like everybody else does. They don't get that incidental learning from just overhearing something and pairing that to their experiences. They go through that, and just kind of seeing them like, oh, that's what that is? That's kind of cool.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. A Northwest Indiana company that's involved in technology has picked up even more business in particular now that the pandemic has come in a different sort of way. A lot of organizations and individuals have to have meetings by way of Zoom these days. Well, SimCorp is jumped into the protection business, so to speak, and the integrity certainly of the systems like that power Zoom. With us to talk about what SimCorp has been doing and picked up some very important creds because of it, we have Robert Johnson. He is the president and CEO of SimCorp, and thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be back with you again.
Well, for folks, the last time we talked, it's been a while, so they may have forgotten what SimCorp is all about. If you will, describe the company, how you got started, and in particular, how apparently you got the folks at Zoom interested in the products that you put out.
SimCorp is a company that develops cybersecurity software, primarily focused on enterprise. Our software helps companies and organizations identify exactly what has changed in terms of their IT systems throughout enterprise. So what that means is that if something on one of your critical servers changes, we will identify it in real time, let you know about it in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And then our software has some self-healing capabilities. So we actually can help your servers automatically return back to that original state of integrity. And we can help in terms of servers, in terms of network devices, web servers, domain controllers, all of the key items in your infrastructure that really ensure that your business is running in an expected state. So you asked how we got started into this business. Mm-hmm. Well, this product has been around for about 13 years. The product is called SimTrack, and initially it wasn't focused on the general enterprise. We were actually, the first version of our software was focused on the process automation and control industry, you know, manufacturing facilities.
Right.
What we saw, because initially our business was focused on automating manufacturing facilities, was that regardless of the organization, of the company, it felt as if there weren't strong controls on the plant floor for ensuring that systems weren't hacked. So the first version of our software was really focused on helping that particular segment of the economy. As we started trying to market to that segment, we realized that there was a lot of education that still needed to occur in that segment. So we ended up pivoting and moving towards the general enterprise because what we're trying to accomplish and the problems we're trying to solve really apply to the entire enterprise, to all of the IT industry.
Did you discover that when the pandemic hit and we were in many cases locked in where we happened to be, whether it was home or when we got back into our businesses, wherever we happened to work, that there was so much use of cyber tools out there, and there was maybe even a much greater need, certainly for cybersecurity, beyond what whatever had been thought before?
Yes, there was a much greater need. Once the pandemic hit, we saw a big spike in, you know, the number of attacks every day and the impact. But what wasn't aligned with that was the fear of organizations. Many organizations were concerned that due to the pandemic, there will be some economic effect.
Right.
So they were cutting back on budgets. And some were cutting back even on security spending. And that's concerning because, as you indicated, at this point, cybersecurity is not a discretionary expense. It's something that's critical. It's expected that cybercrime alone is going to cost the world about $6 trillion annually by 2021. And you know what? That's up from $3 trillion in 2015. And to keep this in perspective, Chris, that means that will be the greatest transfer of economic wealth in history going to cybercriminals. That will be more profitable, just to put it in perspective, than the global trade of all illegal drugs combined. And it's all happening underneath our noses via hacking and cybercrime.
Wow, wow. I know that Zoom, of course, is seemingly, although there are other platforms out there that are often used for meetings, and in turn that seems to be that Zoom is one of the biggest. It's used an awful lot. And I know that as the pandemic really took place and people had to start working from home, had to start meeting from home with their conference calls, switching over from telephones basically to video conferencing. And we noticed that Zoom was having an awful lot of problems. They were overwhelmed at the very beginning. Was SimCorp able to help them keep from many major problems, especially from the cyber criminals from getting into the system? Because we know that they've had hackers in some conferences. They've had people jump on and cause little hassles. But you know, nothing major. But could get a lot worse, couldn't it?
It could get a lot worse. I don't think that Zoom's problems were that major. Their core infrastructure was always quite secure.
Mm-hmm.
We started working with Zoom initially in 2019 on some components of their infrastructure. And as once the pandemic hit, they had to quickly ramp up and scale out their infrastructure. So that's when we really accelerated our partnership and worked with them to protect their infrastructure as it grew. Some of the items that you mentioned, such as people jumping into Zoom conferences, things like that,
mm-hmm.
those weren't really indicative of any security threats on their core infrastructure. Those were some optional settings that needed to be configured inside of Zoom that they've actually decided to make standard now and on by default to ensure that people need passwords to jump into the Zoom rooms or to have waiting areas. So they've taken some precautions to make sure that every meeting is configured in a way that is secure. But their back-end infrastructure security, they've always taken very seriously, and we've seen it firsthand, even as they scale at this tremendous speed.
Well, it seems, Mr. Johnson, that the folks at Zoom were very wise in choosing SimCorp, almost from the beginning, certainly, in the years prior to the pandemic, to be able to get their house in order so they wouldn't have the problems that many companies probably run into now.
I think so. They have a great team there at Zoom, and they're very responsive, and they're incredibly intelligent. So we love working with that team.
What kind of a setup did you have to establish early on? And I'm referring to just prior to the pandemic really, really hitting home for all businesses in the United States and around the world. What kind of setup did you have to work with Zoom and perhaps other customers as well, too, that SimCorp deals with the SimTrack Integrity Suite that you have set up?
We've developed cybersecurity software. So it's a software package that they install in their own infrastructure. So for Zoom in particular, we helped them to actually set up the rules and configure our product in their infrastructure. And this is something that didn't start at the beginning of the pandemic. This is something that started back in 2019, just ramped up once the pandemic actually took effect. And same for our other customers. So we focus on creating great software and having it available all the time. And we focus on making it extremely simple to implement our product, because we feel that if a cybersecurity tool is too difficult to use, ultimately people aren't going to use it. And that's the number one thing we need to push, is for companies to actually use the tools that they're implementing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that besides the security end, that SimCorp has provided Zoom with some compliance technology. For folks that are not IT people, can you explain what compliance technology is and certainly how SimTrack seems to fit in with your suites?
All right, that's a good question. Let's talk about why people use our tool. Mm-hmm. They fall into two camps. You have some folks that would use our tool from a security perspective to help ensure that their systems haven't changed in any way that they didn't expect it to change. And then in the other camp, we have folks that would use our tool from a compliancy perspective. And those are companies that have to deal with different regulatory and compliance issues. Perhaps they process a lot of credit card transactions, or perhaps they're in a financial services industry or a healthcare organization, and they have to deal with HIPAA. All of those organizations have a set of regulations that they must comply with. So, and in many cases, those regulations indicate that you must have a strong change control process and understand all the changes and document them, document all material changes to your infrastructure. And that is exactly what our tool can help you achieve, is some of that change management, change control process in your infrastructure and meet some of those compliance requirements. In addition to that, we also can help assess, our software can help assess using CIS benchmarks. And that's basically a set of tests.
Mm-hmm.
It can help assess your infrastructure to see where you stand in terms of different compliances, whether we're talking PCI for credit card transactions, HIPAA for healthcare, NERC-SIP inside of utilities, and about 70 other compliances that we can actually help companies meet all the requirements for.
Well, Mr. Johnson, you certainly, as representing SimCorp, well-positioned to help companies deal with not only the IT problems the pandemic has brought on and help deal with get some of those areas resolved, and looking to the future as well, too. Thank you for spending time with us, and maybe some congratulations are in order for being such a good client to the Zoom and helping them deal with some of their behind-the-scenes problems they might get with all those conferences that they have to handle out there every single day.
They do, and thank you very much, Chris, for having me on your show. Okay. Thanks for all your support over the years.
Robert Johnson is the CEO of SimCorp, which is based in Merrillville, Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.